time being, at least, I truly was a Cambridge undergraduate. You see, each staircase has at its entrance a wooden board on which are hand-painted the names of the occupants residing within. Next to each name is a sliding block of wood that obscures or reveals the words in and out, so that when a student or fellow, for the dons have rooms in college too, passes the board on their way to or from their rooms, they can signal their presence or absence to an anxious and expectant world. I was happily flicking my block of wood back and forth, and would still have been doing so to this very day if the sound of approaching footsteps hadn't sent me scuttling up to my rooms. I had arrived that afternoon with a collection of carefully chosen books, a typewriter, a gramophone, a pile of records, some posters, and a bust of Shakespeare, all of which were soon disposed about the rooms in as pleasing and artfully artless an arrangement as I could contrive. Undergraduate sets are composed of a bedroom, a main room, and a gyp room or kitchen. Gyp was the unfortunate nickname for a college servant. The more appealing Oxonian appellation is scout, but I'm not going to get sidetracked with Oxbridge minutiae again, I promise. I know how much it upsets you. I had determined that I would go out later for coffee, milk, and other staples. For the moment, I was content to sit alone, but for 24 or so invitations carefully laid out on my desk. In the days before email and mobile phones, communication was managed by notes left in a student's pigeonhole in the porter's lodge. If someone wanted to contact you, it was much easier for them to leave a message there than to have the fag of climbing all the way to your rooms and slipping it under your door. I had already gone down to the porter's lodge 3 times in the last hour to see if any more invitations had come in. The pigeonholes were arranged and colour-coded according to undergraduate year. Thus, a club or society could undertake a mass leafleting of first years, a kind of targeted spamming. Hence the quantity of paper spread out on my desk. The invitations to squashes being held by sporting, political or religious societies I had instantly thrown away, but I had grouped together invitations from dramatic and literary clubs, magazines and journals. What about the Cambridge University Gay Society? I was undecided about this. I liked the idea of pinning my pink colours to the mincy mast, but was wary of being involved in anything campaigning or strident. In those days, I was a most conservative, or at least actively inactive, sort of figure politically. In the jargon of the day, my consciousness was unawakened. Invitations to sherry parties held by the college's senior tutor, by the dean of chapel, and by an entirely different person also claiming the title of dean were not to be refused, I was told. Also essential was a gathering in the rooms of A.C. Spearing, the college's senior English fellow, who was to be, it seemed, my director of studies. The most impressive and formal invitation, all pasteboard gold embossing and armorial bearings, was the one summoning me to the Queen's College matriculation dinner, a formal event in which the entire intake of first years would be officially received and enrolled as members of the college. And so I embarked on this round of parties and introductory gatherings. In A.C. Spearing's rooms, I met my fellow English literature freshers. We stuck together in the first week, accompanied each other to assorted squashes and introductory lectures, swapped second-hand gossip, and sized each other up academically, intellectually, socially, and in one or two cases, I suppose, sexually. We were very typical of our generation. We knew T.S. Eliot backwards, but could barely quote a line of Spencer or Dryden between us. With the exception of one of our number, we would have looked like, to an outside observer, as prize a parcel of punchably pompous and buttoned-up arseholes as ever was assembled in one place. The exception was a bondage-trousered, leather-jacketed, henna-haired youth called Dave Huggins. He looked like the kind of punk rocker you would cross the King's Road in Chelsea to avoid. Despite being far and away the friendliest and most approachable of our group, he scared the hell out of me and, I think, out of everybody else, too. Something in my booming voice and apparently confident manner seemed to appeal to him, however, or amuse him at least, and he dubbed me the King. For all his forbidding street aspect, Dave had been to school at Radley, one of the smarter public schools. In fact, almost all of us in the English literature intake had been privately educated. Unsure of ourselves and nervous of being found academically wanting as we may have been, I cannot imagine how alarmingly and alienatingly at home we must have seemed to those arriving from state schools, to that cadre of young men and women who had never before stayed away from home and never before met public school product en masse. Some months later, a student who had been educated at a comprehensive in southeast London told me that for weeks he had been unable to understand what "say gid" meant. He kept hearing it everywhere. "Say gid. That's just say gid." Eventually he realised that it was how the upper middle class pronounce "so good." That's just so good. He observed how strange it was for him to be in the minority. Some 3% of the population received private education in those days, and here he was, one of the great 97%, but somehow feeling like a chimney sweep whose gate crashed a Hunt ball. No matter how much Cambridge might have presented itself as a purely academic institution, whose only criterion for entry was academic, the dominant accent to be heard was public school. It took a very special kind of self-belief and strength of character not to feel angry or out of place in such an environment. I have no idea what kind of a figure I cut. Well, that's not true. I'm afraid I have all too clear an idea of what kind of a figure I cut. My typical mode of dress was a Harris tweed jacket with leather buttons, viola shirt and knitted tie, V-neck lambswool sweater, corduroy trousers of lovet green, and brown half-brogue shoes polished to a high gloss. With my trademark flop of hair and a pipe clamped between my teeth, I looked like what I, of course, had been all the previous year, an assistant master from a small rural prep school, perhaps with something of the air of a Second World War backroom boffin. Whatever impression I gave, it certainly wasn't that of a hip young rocker in the age of the Clash and the Damned. Chess, classics, classical composers, curiosity, and cheating. It turned out that Queen's did indeed have two deans, a dean of chapel and a dean in charge of discipline. At each of the first week decanal sherry parties, I found myself falling into conversation with a first year called Kim Harris. He was handsome in a way that reminded me of a young Richard Burton and radiated a powerful mixture of severity, secrecy, relish and surprise that I could not but find intriguing. Like me, he was separated from other freshers by appearing on the one hand more mature and adult, while on the other exhibiting an unembarrassedly high doctrine of what Cambridge ought to be. He was educated, I soon discovered, at Bolton School, an independent day school that a generation or two earlier had thrown Ian McKellen at Cambridge and a grateful world. Kim had come to Queen's to read classics. He dressed rather like me, but in Church's full brogues and V-necks of the purest and priciest cashmere. He was even capable of wearing a bow tie without looking absurd, which is a very great human skill indeed. We became instant friends in the way that only the young can. We did not consider going to any party or event except in each other's company. "Are you gay?" I asked him quite early on. "Let's just say that I know what I like," was his prim and opaque reply. Aside from his proficiency at Latin and Greek, Kim had another skill, and at a level of brilliance that seemed to me to be quite superhuman. He was a chess master. At Bolton, he had played with and to some extent mentored Nigel Short, who was already becoming well known as the greatest prodigy England had ever produced. At the age of 10, Short had beaten the great Viktor Korchnoi, and now at 14 was on the verge of becoming the youngest international master in history. Kim was just a master, but that meant he was skillful enough to play blindfold, a trick I never tired of urging him to perform. Without any sight of the board, he would demolish all comers. When I first saw him do this, it reminded me to raise a point with him. "Kim," I said, "when we very first met at one of those sherry parties, I remember we looked at a chessboard in the dean's rooms and I asked you if you played chess."
"So you did."
"And do you remember what you replied?"
Kim raised his eyebrows. "I don't think so."
"You said, 'Let's just say I know the moves.'"
"Well, I do."
"You know a bit more than the moves," I said.
"Your point being?"
"My point being, if that's how you answer someone who asks you if you play chess, how am I to interpret it when you answer the question, 'Are you gay?' with the words, 'Let's just say I know what I like.'" Kim's family was well off, and they lavished upon their only son every imaginable luxury, including a magnificent Bang & Olufsen stereo system on which Kim played Wagner, and sang to Wagner, and conducted Wagner, and lived Wagner. I had fallen for Wagner's music myself when young, but I'd never penetrated the mysteries of the full works. Aside from anything else, I'd never been able to afford the huge box sets. As well as Lohengrins and Meistersingers and a Parsifal or two, Kim had two complete Ring cycles on record, Carl Böhm's live Bayreuth recording and the great Decca studio production of the Schulte Ring, one of the masterpieces of the gramophone age. I know how bored and restless people become at talk of Wagner, so I won't dwell on him at length. Let it just be said that Kim completed my Wagnerian education, and for that alone I would be grateful to him forever. He and I, and a friend of his from Bolton called Peter Speak, who was reading philosophy, would sit around discovering late 19th-century masterpieces over which to go into ecstasies. Strauss, Schoenberg, Brahms, Mahler, and Bruckner were our gods, and Kim's B&O our temple. Given that Britain was boiling with anarchic post-punk creativity, the political excitements of multiple strikes and the election of Margaret Thatcher to the leadership of the Conservative Party, that there was rubbish piling up on the streets, corpses going unburied, and inflation rocketing skywards, given all that, a knot of tweedy Cambridge late adolescents gasping at the wonder of Strauss's Metamorphosis and Schoenberg's Transfigured Night seems what? Perfectly legitimate, entirely in accordance with what education is supposed to be. Education is the sum of what students teach each other in between lectures and seminars. You sit in each other's rooms and drink coffee. I suppose it would be vodka and Red Bull now. You share enthusiasms. You talk a lot of wank about politics, religion, art and the cosmos, and then you go to bed, alone or together, according to taste. I mean, how else do you learn anything? How else do you take your mind for a walk? Nonetheless, I'm slightly shocked at how earnest and dull a picture I present in my tweed jacket and corduroys, puffing at a pipe and listening to all that German late romantic noise. Is that where it all went wrong? Or is that where it all went right? There is that in student life which reinforces the connection between the words university and universal. All divisions of life are there. And all the circles and sodalities, coteries and cliques that you will find in the wider human cosmos can be found in the swirling flux of young people who shape and define a university for the 3 or 4 years of their tenancy. Whenever I return to Cambridge, I wander the familiar streets as a stranger. I know and love the architecture intimately, but while the chapels and colleges, courts, bridges and towers are what they have always been, Cambridge is entirely different each time. You cannot step into the same river twice, observed Heraclitus, for fresh water is always flowing over you. You cannot step into the same Cambridge twice, or the same Bristol or Warwick or Leeds or any such place, for fresh generations are forever repopulating and redefining them. The buildings are frozen, but a university is not its buildings. It is those that inhabit and use them. I discovered brilliant people and dunces and everything in between. There were the lively and there were the preternaturally dull. Every imaginable special interest was represented. You could spend your 3 years as an undergraduate on sports fields and never know there were any theatres. You could involve yourself in politics and be wholly unaware of orchestras or choirs. You could hunt with beagle packs, sail, dance, play bridge, build a computer or tend a garden, just as you can at hundreds of universities, of course. It is only that Cambridge has the advantage of being both bigger and smaller than most. Smaller because you're in a college of perhaps 300, bigger because the whole university numbers over 20,000, which confers some sort of an advantage when it comes to audiences and participants in sport and drama, readership circulations for magazines, and captive markets for all sorts of enterprises and undertakings. I need not, of course, have worried that I would be quizzed and found wanting on the subject of Russian poets or the principles of particle physics. The fear proved groundless that I would find myself in such rarefied heights of academic brilliance that I would be unable to breathe. To do well at exams, in the field of literature and the arts at least, it is better to be a hedgehog than a fox, if I can borrow Isaiah Berlin's famous distinction. In other words, it is better to know one big thing than lots of smaller things. A point of view, a single way of thinking that encompasses all elements of a subject, allows essays more or less to write themselves. The way to pass exams is to cheat. I cheated all the way through my 3 years at Cambridge, which is not to say that I looked at the work of the student next to me or that I brought in outside material from which to crib. I cheated by knowing in advance exactly what I was going to write before the invigilator bade us turn over the question sheets and start the clock. I had a theory of Shakespearean tragic and comic forms, for example, which I won't bore you with and which is probably specious, or at least no more truthful or persuasive an overall interpretation of Shakespeare's forms than any other. Its virtue was that it answered any question and yet always appeared to be specific. I'd found part of it in an essay by Anne Barton, nay, writer. She is a fine Shakespearean scholar, and I filleted and regurgitated some of her ideas for both parts one and two of the Tripos. Cambridge calls its degree examination the Tripos, something to do with the three-legged stool on which students used to sit when taking them. In both of the Shakespeare papers, I got a first. In fact, in part two, it was the top first for the entire university. It was essentially the same essay each time. It only takes a paragraph at the top to twist the question such that your essay answers it. Let's say, in simple terms, that my essay proposes that Shakespeare's comedies, even the festive ones, play with being tragedies, while his tragedies play with being comedies. The point is that you can trot this essay out no matter what the question. Shakespeare's real voice is in his comedies. Discuss. King Lear is Shakespeare's only likable tragic hero. Discuss. Shakespeare outgrew his comedies. Shakespeare put his talent into his comedies and his genius into his tragedies. Tragedies are adolescent, comedies are adult. Shakespeare cares about gender but not about sex. Discuss, 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 discuss. I did, of course, no such vulgar thing as discuss. All my ducks were in a row when I walked into the examination hall, and I had to do no more than point their beaks at the question. Of course, having a good memory helped. I had enough quotations in my head, both from the works and from Shakespearean critics and scholars, to be able to pepper my essay with acute references. So creepily good was that memory that I was always able to include act, scene and line numbers for every play quotation, or to place in brackets the source and date of any critical reference I cited. Witwatersrand Review, Volume 3, September 75, Ed Jablonski, Yale Books, 1968, that sort of thing. I am aware that to be given a good memory at birth is worth more than almost any other accomplishment, but I believe, too, that it is as rare for one person to be born with a physically better memory as it is for them to be born with better fingers or better legs. There are young men and women up and down the land who happily or unhappily tell anyone who will listen that they don't have an academic turn of mind, or that they aren't lucky enough to have been blessed with a good memory, and yet can recite hundreds of pop lyrics and reel off any amount of information about footballers, cars and celebrities. Why? Because they are interested in those things. They are curious. If you are hungry for food, you are prepared to hunt high and low for it. If you are hungry for information, it is the same. Information is all around us, now more than ever before in human history. You barely have to stir or incommode yourself to find things out. The only reason people do not know much is because they do not care to know. They are incurious. Incuriosity is the oddest and most foolish failing there is. Picture the world as being a city whose pavements are covered a foot deep in gold coins. You have to wade through them to make progress. Their clinking and rattling fills the air. Imagine that you meet a beggar in such a city. "Please give me something. I am penniless." "But look around you," you would shout. "There's gold enough to last you your whole life. All you have to do is bend down and pick it up." When people complain that they don't know any literature because it was badly taught at school, or that they missed out on history because on the timetable it was either that or biology, or some such ludicrous excuse, it is hard not to react in the same way. "But it's all around you," I want to scream. "All you have to do is bend down and pick it up." What on earth people think their lack of knowledge of the Hundred Years' War or Socrates or the colonization of Batavia has to do with school, I have no idea. As one who was expelled from any number of educational establishments and never did any work at any of them, I know perfectly well that the fault lay not in the staff, but in myself that I was ignorant. Then one day, or over the course of time, I got greedy. greedy to know things, greedy for understanding, greedy for information. I was always to some extent like that robot, number 5, in the movie Short Circuit, who whizzes about shrieking, "Input! Input!" Memorising for me became like eating sugar puffs, an endless stuffing of myself. I do not say that this hunger for learning was morally, intellectually, or stylistically admirable. I think it was a little like ambition, a little like many of the later failings in my life we will come to. Membership of so many clubs, ownership of so many credit cards. It was part of wanting to belong, of feeling the need constantly to connect myself. Rather vulgar, rather pushy. While the manner and motives of it may not have been magnificent, the end result was certainly useful. The urgent desire to pack the mind by insatiable curiosity and appetite for knowledge led to all kinds of advantages. Facile exam passing was one such. I had never found written tests under time pressure anything other than enjoyable and easy. That is because of my fundamental dishonesty. I never tried to engage authentically or truthfully with an intellectual issue or to answer a question. I only tried to show off, and in the course of my life I have met few people who are my equal at that undignified art. There are plenty who are more obviously show-offy than I am, but that is what is so creepy about my particular brand of exhibitionism. I mask it in a cloak of affable modesty and touching false diffidence. To be less hard on myself, I think these displays of affability, modesty, and diffidence may once have been false, but have now become pretty much real, in much the same way that the conscious manner we decide to sign our names in our teens will slowly stop being affected and become our real signature. The mask, if worn long enough, will be the face. All of which seems a long way from a memoir of university life, which is what this chapter is supposed to offer. The life of a student, however, especially that of a more than usually self-conscious student in an institution like Cambridge, does involve a great deal of questioning of the mind and intellectual faculties and the meaning and purpose of scholarship, so I think it right to try and fathom what my mind was about in those days. I went to 3 lectures in my entire 3 years. I can remember only 2, but I'm sure I went to another. The first was an introductory talk on Langland's Piers Plowman by J.A.W. Bennett, who had been installed as C.S. Lewis's successor in the chair of medieval and Renaissance literature in 1963, and seemed old enough to have lived through much of the period of which he had made himself a master. His lecture was a monumentally dull explanation of why the B text of Piers Plowman, an achingly long work of Middle English allegorical alliterative verse, was more to be relied upon than the C text, or possibly the other way around. Professor Bennett begged leave to disagree with W.W. Skeat on the issue of the A text's rendering of the harrowing of hell, blah-de-blah-de-blah. That was enough for me. I knew that 5 minutes in the faculty library would let me dig up a rare enough article in the Sewanee Review or similar to furnish fodder for an essay. Lectures broke into one's day and were clearly a terrible waste of time. Necessary, no doubt, if you were reading law or medicine or some other vocational subject, but in the case of English, the natural thing to do was to talk a lot, listen to music, drink coffee and wine, read books, and go to plays. Perhaps be in plays. I regularly get letters from aspiring actors or their parents asking for advice. If I get lots, you can imagine how many Ian McKellen, Judy Dench, Simon Russell Beale, David Tennant, and other legitimate actors must get. The phrase crowded profession is used more for the acting business than for any other I have ever heard of, and for good reason. As in so many fields in life, there are people out there longing to be given a secret, a way in, a technique. I can understand it absolutely. Almost as common as the phrase crowded profession are phrases that express the idea of just need a break and not what you know but who you know. I am excluding, for the time being, the whole issue of fame and concentrating exclusively on those who actually care about acting in and of itself. I expect we will come to those who obsess about the ancillary benefits of red carpet recognition and celebrity magazine coverage later. The letter writers want to know the best way to achieve a foothold in the acting profession. All that is required, they know, is a chance, one opportunity to shine. Their talent, industry, and commitment will do the rest. They know, the world knows, how much luck has to do with it. They may have heard about some young striver who wrote a letter to an established actor and got a role as a walk-on in a film, or an audition, or a place at a drama school as a result. What a creep or ungrateful beast you would have to be not to be moved by the cries of those on the outside who clamour for admission. If you have been lucky enough to advance in the profession, surely the least you can do is offer a hand or a word of helpful advice to those who would emulate you. Absolutely right. But one must be honest, too. I can only advise from experience. If someone asks me how to do something, I cannot answer in the abstract. I can only answer according to my own history. I have absolutely no idea how to become an actor. I can only tell you how I became one. Or at least how I became a sort of actor, who is also a sort of writer, who is also a sort of comedian, who is also a sort of broadcaster, who is also a sort of all sorts of all sorts sort of. That is the best I can do. I cannot pronounce on whether it is better to go to drama school or not to go. I cannot advise on whether to do rep or street theatre before attempting film or television. I cannot tell you whether it is deleterious or beneficial to the career to take on extra work or accept a part in a soap opera. I simply do not know the answer to these questions because they have never arisen in my life. It would be reckless and irresponsible of me to push someone towards or away from courses of action or inaction of which I know nothing. So here is how I became an actor. At prep school, the school play was always a musical, so the best casting I could ever hope for would be in the non-singing roles. Mrs. Higgins in My Fair Lady was an especial triumph. Would grace any drawing room, being my first published critical notice. At Uppingham, I wrote and performed with my friend Richard Fawcett in comedy sketches for house suppers, as Christmas entertainments were called there. I also made a mark as a witch in Macbeth. I say made a mark because the director, in a burst of creative license which he must have regretted ever afterwards, thought we should devise our own characters, costumes and props. I went to the butcher's in Uppingham and procured a bucket of pig's guts to pull out of the cauldron for the eye of toad and ear of newt scene. My dear, the smell! The next time I appeared on stage was at the Norfolk College of Arts and Technology in King's Lynn. Norcat's lecturer in charge of drama was called Bob Poles, and he cast me first as Creon in a double bill of Sophocles' Oedipus Rex and Antigone, and then as Lysander in A Midsummer Night's Dream. I was camp and wore a cricket pullover. As Lysander, that is, not as Creon. My only other dramatic experience took place in a local church performance of Charles Williams's Thomas Cranmer of Canterbury, a verse play by the other member of the Inklings, i.e. the one who wasn't J.R.R. Tolkien or C.S. Lewis. That was the sum total of my dramatic experience, nativity plays aside, when I arrived at Cambridge. Yet I had it in my head that I was a natural actor, that I knew how to speak lines, that I would have a presence on stage, a weight, a heft, an ability to draw focus when required. I think this was because I was always confident about my voice and my ability to speak verse and to inflect and balance speech properly without the misplaced emphases and false stresses that I could hear so clearly in the voices of prefects and other amateurs when they read lessons in chapel or recited verse or dramatic lines on stage. The few prizes I had won at school were for poetry reading or recitation of one kind or another. In the same way as one might wince at a discord, I would wince at incompetent intonation and wish that I could get up and correct them. Such a point of view now strikes me as arrogance and insolent presumption, but I suppose a conviction that one can do better is a necessary part of the self-belief that is itself a necessary part of pursuing a calling. Heroes matter too. Everyone I've ever met whom I've admired has grown up with their own pantheon of heroes. I listened to, watched and admired Robert Donat, Laurence Olivier, of course, Orson Welles, Maggie Smith, James Stewart, Bette Davis, Alistair Sim, Ralph Richardson, John Gielgud, Paul Scofield, Charles Laughton, Marlon Brando, Natch, James Mason, Anton Woolbrook, Patrick Stewart, Michael Bryant, Derek Jacobi, Ian McKellen and John Wood. There were many others, but those I especially remember. I had not seen a great deal of theatre, but John Wood and Patrick Stewart at the Royal Shakespeare Company had made an enormous impression. I did impersonations of Stewart's Enobarbus and Cassius in the coach on the way back to school. The others in my list are fairly obvious choices for someone of my background and generation, I suppose. When I was about 12, my parents took me to the Theatre Royal in Norwich with the promise of Sir Laurence Olivier. The play was Somerset Maugham's Home and Beauty, at least I think it was. Memory can conflate different productions and evenings. Maybe it was something else. When I settled in my seat and opened the programme, I saw that the production was directed by Laurence Olivier. My heart sank. I had so hoped that I would see the theatrical legend in person. When the play was over, my mother asked how I had liked it. "It was fine," I said, "but the best bit was the man who came on as the lawyer at the end. I mean, even the way he took off his hat was extraordinary. Who was he?" "But that was Olivier," said my mother. "Didn't you realise?" I can still picture exactly the way he stood on stage, the angle of his head, the extraordinary ability he had to make you all look at each of his fingers, one after the other, as he tugged off his gloves with aching deliberation. He played a dry-as-dust solicitor in a small comic turn in the play's last scene, but it was astounding. Shameless exhibitionism, of course, a far cry from the honest, gutsy endeavours of 1,000 hard-working actors mining for the psychological and emotional truths of their characters in theatres and studios up and down the land, but damn, it was fun. I was pleased at least that I found it amazing, even without knowing who the actor was. So, at Cambridge, although I loved the art and idea of acting, I had no theories about theatre as an agent of social or political change and no ambition for it as a future career. If I had faith in my potential, I certainly had no particular sense that it would be on comic roles that I should concentrate. Quite the reverse. Theatre to me meant, first and foremost, Shakespeare. And the comic roles in the canon, fools, jesters, clowns and mechanicals, didn't really suit me at all. I was more a Theseus or Oberon than a Bottom or Quince, more a Duke or Jaques than a Touchstone. But first there was the question of whether I would even dare put myself forward for consideration. Cambridge had dozens and dozens of drama clubs. Each college had its own, and there were others that were university-wide. The major ones, like the Marlowe Society, the Footlights and the Amateur Dramatic Club, had long histories. The Marlowe was started by Justin Brooke and Dady Rylands 100 years ago. The ADC and Footlights were older still. Others were more recent. The Mummers had been founded by Alistair Cook and Michael Redgrave in the early 1930s and clung to a more progressive and avant-garde identity. Many at Cambridge will tell you that the drama world there is filled with ambitious, pretentious, bitchy wannabes, and that the atmosphere of backbiting, jealousy and greasy pole rivalry is suffocating and unbearable. The people who tell you this are cut from the same cloth as those who grow up these days to become trollers on internet sites and who specialise in posting barbarous, mean, abusive, look-at-me, listen-to-me anonymous comments on YouTube and BBC Have Your Say pages and other websites and blogs foolish enough to allow space for their poison. Such swine specialise in second-guessing the motives of those who are brave enough to commit to the risk of making fools of themselves in public, and they are a blight on the face of the earth. Oh, but a thick skin is surely necessary in the acting profession. Actors and theatre people should get used to it. Well, if you want to be in a profession which accesses emotion and attempts to penetrate the mind and soul of man, I should have thought that what is more necessary is a thin skin, sensitivity. But I'm wandering off the point. I thought, as I settled into my first term, that I should at least go to see some plays and decide whether or not I would be completely outclassed and out of my league. No point in going to auditions if I didn't have a hope of doing anything more than carry a spear. I should point out, for those unfamiliar with the world of British university drama, that none of this had anything to do with grown-ups, with dons, lecturers, officials, or the university departments and faculties. This was all as extracurricular as drink, sex, or sport. I know that in American universities, a lot of these activities actually give you points towards your degree, credits, I believe they're called, not in Britain. Universities that offer drama courses do exist here, Manchester and Bristol, for example, but not the majority, and certainly not Cambridge. Drama and activities of that sort have nothing to do with your academic work. You find your own time to do them. As a result, such pursuits flower, fruit, and flourish as nowhere else. If I'd had to submit to some drama teacher casting me in plays, directing me, or telling me how it was done, I should have withered on the vine. The beauty of our way was that everyone was learning as they went along. The actors and directors were all students, as were the lighting, sound, set construction, costume, stage management, production crew, front of house and administration. All were undergraduates saying, "Oh, this looks like fun." How did they learn? Well, that's the beauty of university life. You learn on the job, and you learn from the second years and third years above you, who in turn learned on the job, and from those above them. My God, but it is exciting. As exciting as I should find official drama training, dull, numbing, embarrassing, and humiliating. All you need is enthusiasm, passion, tirelessness, and the will, the hunger, and the need to do it. But within that range, there's plenty of room for the amiable rugger player who thinks it will be larky to be in the chorus of a musical, or the nervous scholarly type who wouldn't mind a shot at a one-line role in a Shakespeare tragedy just for the sensation of experiencing a play from the inside. You don't have to be a professional in the making at all. Where did the money come from to build sets and make costumes? From previous productions. Every drama club had a committee, mostly second and third years, and someone on that committee looked after the budgets and the money. It was not just a way of learning about drama, it was a way of learning about committee life, diligence, accounting, and all the perils and pitfalls of business and management. Sometimes a don would be asked to sit on the board of a club to help oversee financial matters, but they had no more power over the committee than any other individual member of it. The Footlights, it was rumoured, was the only Cambridge club in any field big and profitable enough to have to pay corporation tax. I don't know if that was true, but the fact that such a rumour could have got about tells you something of the scale of some of these enterprises. The momentum of continuity was a huge part of it. These clubs had been running for so long that it was relatively simple to keep them going. The first production I went to see was of Tom Stoppard's Travesties. The play is set in Zurich, and somehow combines in a farcical world Lenin, who had been exiled there for a while, Tristan Tzara, the Dadaist, the novelist James Joyce, and an English consul called Henry Carr, who is in the process of mounting a production of Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest. The production was co-directed by Bridget Lama, now artistic director of the Watford Palace Theatre, and Annabel Arden, who directs opera around the world. At the time, there were very smart first years who had hit the ground running. The others in the cast will forgive me, I hope, if I fail to recount their own admirable contributions to the success of the evening. Although it was a truly excellent production in and of itself, what stood out for me above all else was the performance of just one of the actresses. The girl who played Gwendolyn stood out like a good deed in a naughty world. She seemed like Athene to have arrived in the world fully armed. Her voice, her movement, her clarity, ease, poise, wit... Well, you had to be there. One of the best things any performer on stage can do, whether stand-up comic, torch singer, ballet dancer, character actor or tragedian, is to relax an audience, to let them know that everything is going to be all right and that they can lean back in their seats, happy in the knowledge that the evening won't be a disaster. Of course, another of the best things a performer can do is provoke a feeling of excitement, danger, unpredictability and instability, to let the audience know that the evening might fail at any moment and that they need to lean forward in their seats and watch intently. If you can manage both at once, then you are really something. This girl was really something. Medium height, with a perfect English complexion, she was gravely beautiful, extraordinarily funny, and commandingly assured beyond her years. Her name, the programme told me, was Emma Thompson. In the interval, I heard someone say that she was the daughter of Eric Thompson, the voice of the Magic Roundabout. Fast forward to March 1992. For her performance as Margaret Schlegel in Howard's End, Emma has won the Academy Award for Best Actress. Journalists are ringing round all her old friends to find out what they think of this. Now, it's a kind of unwritten rule that when the press asks you to speak about someone else, you never say a word unless that person has cleared it with you beforehand. If one wants to talk about oneself to a journalist, that is fine, but it really isn't on to blather about a third party without their permission. One persistent journalist, having been more or less rebuffed by all of Emma's old friends, somehow gets hold of Kim Harris's number. "Hello? Hi. I'm from the Post. I understand you're an old university friend of Emma Thompson's." "Yes." "I wonder if you've anything to say about her Oscar. Are you surprised? Do you think she deserves it?" "I have to come right out and tell you," says Kim, that I feel betrayed, let down, and most disappointed by Emma Thompson. The journalist almost drops his phone. Kim can hear the sound of a pencil being sucked, and then, he later swears, of drool hitting the carpet.
Betrayed? Really?
Yeah, go on. Anyone who ever saw Emma Thompson at university, says Kim, would have laid substantial money on her getting an Oscar before she was 30. She's now just over 30. It's a crushing disappointment. Not as crushing a disappointment as that felt by the journalist who for one second thought he had a story. Kim, as he so often does, put it perfectly. That really was all there was to say. Plenty of other students were talented, some prodigiously so, and one might guess that with a fair following wind, the right opportunities and a measure of guidance and growth, they would have decent or even brilliant careers. With Emma, you just saw her once and you knew. Stardom. Oscar. Damehood. That last is up to her, of course, but you can guarantee it will be offered. Men like their actresses, if they are superb, to be airheaded, ditzy, and charmingly foolish. Emma is certainly capable of refreshingly different approaches to logical thought, but airheaded, ditzy, or foolish she is not. She's one of the most clear-minded and intelligent people I've met. The fact that her second Oscar, 2 years after the first, was awarded for a screenplay tells you all you need to know about her ability to concentrate, think, and work. If it is tempting to be cross with people for having so many gifts lavished on them at birth, she has an abundance of kindness, openness, and sweetness of nature that makes envy or resentment difficult. I am aware that we have entered the treacly territory of darling, she's lovely and gorgeous here, but that is the risk a book like this was always going to run. I did warn you. For those of you who would rather take away some other view of the woman, I can tell you definitively that she is a talentless, mad bitch sow who wanders the streets of North London in nothing but a pair of ill-matched Wellington boots. She only gets parts in films because she sleeps with the producer's animals. Plus, she smells. She never wrote a screenplay in her life. She chains up a writer she drugged at a party 20 years ago, and he is responsible for everything published under her name. Her so-called liberal humanitarian principles are as false as her breasts. She is a member of the Gestapo and regrets the passing of apartheid. That's Emma Thompson for you, the darling of fools and the fool of darlings. Despite or because of this, we got to know each other. She was at the All-Women's College, Newnham, where, like me, she read English. She was funny, very funny, also extreme with her fashion sense. The day came when she decided to shave her head. I blame the influence of Annie Lennox. Emma and I were both in the same seminar group at the English faculty, and one morning, after a stimulating discussion of A Winter's Tale, we walked together down Sidgwick Avenue towards the centre of town. She pulled off her woolly hat so that I could feel the texture of her bare pate. In those days, it was unlikely that anyone would have seen a woman as bald as an egg. A boy riding past on a bicycle turned to stare and, his panic-stricken eyes never leaving Emma's shining scalp, rode straight into a tree. I never thought such things took place outside silent movies, but it happened and it made me happy. The first term came and went without my daring once to attend an audition. I'd seen that there could be actors, or one at least as astonishing as Emma, but there had been plenty getting parts that I felt I could have played better or at least no worse. Nonetheless, I held back. For the most part, my life in college and in the wider university followed a blandly traditional course. I joined the Cambridge Union, which is nothing to do with students' unions, but a debating society with its own chamber, a kind of miniature House of Commons, all wood and leather and stained glass, complete with a gallery and doors marked aye and no, through which you file to vote after the Speaker has put the motion to the House. All a little pompous, really, but ancient and traditional. Many in Margaret Thatcher's cabinet had been Cambridge Union hacks in the early 60s. Norman Fowler, Cecil Parkinson, John Selwyn Gummer, Ken Clark, Norman Lamont, Geoffrey Howe. That bunch. I was not politically inclined enough to want to speak or attempt to work my way into the inner circle of the union, nor was I interested in asking questions from the floor of the House or contributing to debates in any other way. I watched a few. Bernard Levin, Lord Lever, Enoch Powell and a handful of others came to argue about the great issues of the day, whatever they were back then. War, terrorism, poverty, injustice, as I recall, problems that have now all been solved, but which at the time seemed most pressing. There was also a comedy debate once a term, usually with a fanciful motion like, "This House believes in trousers," or "This House would rather be a sparrow than a snail." I went to one where the handlebar mustachioed comedian Jimmy Edwards, drunk as a skunk, played the tuba, told excellent jokes, and afterwards, so I was told, fondled the thighs of all the comely young men at the dinner. I have since been invited many times to debate at Cambridge, Oxford, and other universities, and shiningly comely and shudderingly handsome have been some of the young men who have hosted the evenings. I never quite got the hang of the getting drunk and fondling the thigh business, though. Whether that makes me a gallant and proper gentleman, a cowardly wuss, or an unadventurous prude, I cannot quite make out. Thighs appear to be safe around me. Perhaps this will change as I enter the autumn of my life, and I cease to care so much about how I am judged. Kim had immediately joined the university chess club and was playing for them in matches against other universities. Nobody doubted he would get his blue, or rather half-blue. You are perhaps aware that in Oxford and Cambridge there are such things as sporting blues. You can represent Cambridge, whose colour is light blue, on the hockey field, for example, for just about every game of the season and be far and away the best player on the pitch for all of them. But if you miss the varsity game, the one match against the dark blues, Oxford, you will not be awarded your blue. A blue for either side means you played against the enemy. The boat race and varsity matches in rugby and cricket are the most celebrated encounters, but there are blues contests between Oxford and Cambridge in every imaginable sport, game and competitive activity, from judo to table tennis, from bridge to boxing, from golf to wine tasting. The minor pursuits result in participants being awarded a half-blue, and that is what Kim duly won when he represented Cambridge against Oxford in the varsity chess match at the RAC in Pall Mall, sponsored by Lloyds Bank. He played in that match for every one of his 3 years, winning the prize for best game in 1981. Kim and I were the closest of friends, but we were not yet lovers. He pined for a second year called Robin, and I pined for no one in particular. Love had mauled me too violently in my teenage years, perhaps. I had fallen in love at school so completely, intensely, and soul-rippingly that I had made some sort of unconscious pact with myself, I think, that I would neither betray the purity of that rapturous perfection, I know, but that is how I felt, nor would I ever again open myself up for such pain and torment, exquisite as they were. There were plenty of attractive young men in the colleges and about the town, and a more than statistically usual ratio gave the impression of being as gay can gaily be. I remember one or two drunken evenings in my own or another's bed with attendant fumbling, frotting, fondling, and farcically floppy failure, as well as more infrequent feats of fizzing fanfare and triumphant fleshly fulfilment, but love stayed away. And sensualist as I am in many regards, I seem to miss neither the rewards nor the punishments of carnality. A week or so towards the end of the first term, I was approached and asked if I would sit on the May Ball Committee. Most universities hold a summer party to celebrate the end of exams and the coming long vacation. Oxford has what they call commem balls. Cambridge has May balls. We get one fresher on the committee every year, the president of the committee said to me, so that by the time the May Ball comes around in your last year, you'll know what it's all about. I never dared ask why they had selected me out of all the freshers to be the one to sit on the committee, but I took it as a great compliment. Perhaps they thought I exhibited style, savoir-faire, diablerie, dash, and a graceful party manner, or perhaps they believed that I was the kind of biddable sucker who would be prepared to put in the hours. In any case, I was told, it means you will be president of the May Ball Committee in your third year, which will look really good on the CV. Excellent for getting a job in the city. Already we were moving towards a time when getting a job in the city, rather than being looked at as an embarrassing gateway to clerkly drudgery and dull worthiness, was beginning to be thought of as a glamorous, sexy, and desirable destiny for the elite of the world. The members of the May Ball Committee were, as you might expect, public school men. Many of them were also members of the Cherubs, Queen's College's exclusive dining and drinking club. I know I ought to have looked down on institutions like May Balls and dining clubs with amused scorn, lofty disdain, and impatient wrath, but the moment I heard of the Cherubs' existence, I resolved that I would be elected. I once heard Alan Bennett say of snobbery that it was a very amiable vice, which I found surprising. That is to say, he went on, the kind of snobbery that looks up with admiration is amiable, daft, but amiable. The kind that looks down with contempt is not amiable, not amiable at all. I cannot deny that I am susceptible to a tinge of the amiable kind. I believe I have never looked down on anyone because they are low-born, whatever that might mean, but I cannot deny that I have been glamorized by those who are high-born, whatever that might mean. It is a preposterous weakness, and I could easily pretend that I am immune to it, but the fact is that I am not, so I may as well fess up. I suppose it is, once more, all part of the feeling I have always had of being an outsider, always needing the proof of belonging that those who truly belong never need, or something like that. The Cambridge term is only 8 weeks long. They call it full term, and you are expected to be in residence for all of it. In theory, the permission of a dean or senior tutor is needed for an exeat, if you want to biff off. You can make up your time away during the 2 weeks that bracket either end of full term. I kept full term so that I could go straight up to Cundall and teach there for the 3 weeks they had left of their much longer school term. After Christmas, with my family in Norfolk, it was back to Cundall for a week, and then to Cambridge for the Lent term. The very fact of this being my second term seemed to release something in me, for I went to 3 auditions in the first week. I got the parts I wanted for all of them. I played Jeremiah Sant, an insane Ian Paisley-style Ulsterman, in Peter Luke's dramatisation of the Corvo novel Hadrian the Seventh. The distraught Jewish tailor, who sees a ghost in Wolf Mankiewicz's The Bespoke Overcoat, and someone or other in the Trinity Hall lunchtime production of a play about Scottish nationalism. This set the pattern for a term which saw me running from rehearsals to auditions to theatres and back to auditions and rehearsals and theatres again. Lunchtime, evening and late night were the 3 usual slots for performance. If someone had suggested a morning production, I would have put myself up for that too. I think I was in 12 plays in that 8-week term. I managed 1 essay on Edmund Spenser and went to no lectures or seminars. Supervisions, the Cambridge word for tutorials, were the only more or less compulsory academic intrusion on my new theatrical life. You would go alone or occasionally with one other to a don's rooms, read out the essay you had written, talk about it, and then discuss some other writer, literary movement or phenomenon, and leave promising an essay on that subject for the next week. I became adept at excuses. I'm really sorry, Dr. Holland, but I'm still trying to engage with the eschatology of Paradise Lost. I think I'll take another week to come to terms with it. It is shameful and lowering to confess how I would mine dictionaries of literary and philosophical terms for words like eschatology, synchrosis, and syntagmatic. Fine, fine, take your time. Dr. Holland wouldn't be fooled for a second. Being used to undergraduates, he would be familiar with their tiresome long-word displays. You will already have winced at plenty of them in this book, I dare say. The felid remains incapable of permuting his nevi. And he had probably been in the audience of at least 2 of the plays I had acted in that week and would know perfectly well that I was spending every hour on drama and none on academic work. Cambridge was very relaxed about that kind of thing. As long as they didn't think you were going to fail your degree, there was no danger of them playing the heavy. The chances of failing a degree were fabulously remote. It was perhaps a part of the institution's arrogance that it believed anyone it selected for entrance was necessarily incapable of failure. For the rest, the faculty and college very sensibly left it up to the individual. If you wanted to work hard for a first-class degree, any amount of help was given. If you preferred to spend your time pulling an oar through the water or striding about in tights, roaring pentameters, why then that was fine too. A relaxed atmosphere of trust pervaded the university. That Lent term passed in a blizzard of acting. By the end of it, I was an insider in the small world of Cambridge drama. The little microcosm reflected the esoteric coteries, cliques and factions. I only put the word esoteric in front of coteries because it is an anagram of it, and that pleases me, of the wider world without. The bar of the ADC Theatre was ahum with talk of Artaud and Henri, Stanislavski and Stein, Brecht and Blin. Many a strong-stomached, aspiring sportsman, scientist or politico would have been unable to overhear our talk without vomiting. We probably used the word darling for each other. I certainly did, if not honey-bottom, love-angel or nipple-face. Sickening, I know, but there you are. The derogatory epithet lovey had yet to be ascribed to the theatrical profession, but that's what, avant la lettre, we were. Loveys all. History and precedent might be said to have encouraged us. Peter Hall, John Barton, Richard Eyre, Trevor Nunn, Nick Heitner, James Mason, Michael Redgrave, Derek Jacobi, Ian McKellen, the list of theatrical giants who had leaned up against the same bar and dreamed the same dreams was inspiringly great. So how did I get to that position so fast? Was I really so talented, or was everyone else really so talentless? I wish I knew. I can remember a great many images, occasions, and solid experiences, but the emotional memory behind them is blurred and unresolved. Was I ambitious? Yes, I think in some secret way I was ambitious. Always far too proud to let it show, but hungry for Cambridge's silly microcosmic equivalent of stardom. I suppose when the captain of the college rugger team sees some fresher take to the field and get his first opportunity to make a run and handle the ball, he knows straight away that this person can or cannot play rugby. For all my shortcomings as an actor, physical awkwardness, reliance on speech, tendency to choose ironic ruefulness over raw emotion, I suppose at auditions I showed that I at least had that thing in me that allowed an audience in. Through the occlusions of the past, I can make out a tall, thin, dignified, rumbly-toned student who could look either 17 or 37. He knows how to stand still and look another actor in the eye. He knows how to deliver a line, at least in such a way as to convey its meaning and, if necessary, its majesty. He can, as they say, pull focus onto and off his own self. I'm not so sure about his ability to inhabit a different personality, to live through the arc of his character's journey on stage and all that mother jazz, but he is at least unlikely to be a blush-making embarrassment. The moment I walked on stage for the first time, I felt so absolutely and entirely at home that it was hard for me to remember that I had had almost no experience at all. I loved every single thing about acting. I loved the mockable sides of it, the instant camaraderie and deep affection one felt for everyone else involved. I loved the long conversations about motive. I loved read-throughs and rehearsals and tech runs. I loved trying on costumes and experimenting with makeup. I loved the tingle of nerves as I waited in the wings. I loved the almost mystical, hyper-aesthetic way in which one was aware of each microsecond on stage, of how one could detect precisely where an audience's focus was at any one moment. I loved the thrill of knowing that I was carrying hundreds of people with me, that they were surfing on the ebb and flow of my voice. Taking such pleasure in being on stage really isn't about relishing love, attention, and admiration. It's not about enjoying the power you think you have over an audience. It is simply a question of fulfillment. You feel perfectly alive and magnificently perfected by the knowledge that you are doing what you were put on earth to do. Not so very long ago, I accompanied some northern white rhinos on a journey to Kenya. They were being translocated from the zoo in the Czech Republic that was all they had ever known. It was immeasurably moving to watch these animals raise their top-heavy heads and take in the huge open skies of the savannah and the smells and sounds of a habitat to which their genes had taken millions of years to adapt them. The quick, unbelieving grunts, the waving of their horns from side to side and the twitching in their great hides told you that somewhere inside they knew that they were where they were supposed to be. I will not claim that the stage is my savannah, but I did feel something of the surge of relief and joy at finally having come home that the rhinos seemed to express as they nosed the air of Africa for the first time. It is only a pity that the professional, grown-up theatre won't allow you the same levels of fun and fulfilment. After three performances, or five at the most, student productions are over, and you move on to something else, which I did, and again, and again. The Easter term is when Cambridge springs to life and becomes one of the most marvellous places on earth to be.
As St. John's College alumnus William Wordsworth put it, "Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive, but to be young was very heaven." He was writing less about May Week and more about the French Revolution, but the thought holds better for the first, and I bet that in truth he was thinking more about garden parties than guillotines. The Head of the River competition is held on the Cam twice a year, each college's boat jostling to bump the one ahead and move a place up in the order. The river isn't wide enough to allow a side-by-side regatta, which is why these peculiar Lent and May Week bumps evolved. Lining the riverbank and cheering on my college is probably the most normal Cambridge-y thing I did in my 3 years. Further upriver, the beauty of the backs in late spring and early summer is enough to make the sternest Puritan moan and shiver with delight. Sunlight on the stone of the bridges, willows leaning down to weep and kiss the water, young boys and girls, or boys and boys, or girls and girls, punting up to Grantchester Meadows, bottles of white wine tied with string, trailing through the wake to cool. No kissing in the punt. Careful how you say that, ho-ho. Revising finalists under chestnut trees, books and notes spread out on the grass as they smoke, drink, chatter, flirt, kiss and read. Garden parties on every lawn in every college for the 2 weeks in June that are perversely designated May Week. Dining clubs and societies, dons, clubs and rich individuals serving punch and pims, beer and sangria, cocktails and champagne, blazers and flannels, self-conscious little snobberies and affectations, flushed youth, pampered youth, privileged youth, happy youth. Don't be too hard on them. Suppress the thought that they're all ghastly tosspots who don't know they're born, insufferable poseurs in need of a kick and a slap. Have some pity and understanding. They will get that kick and that slap soon enough. After all, look at them now. They're all in their 50s. Some of them on their 3rd, 4th, or 5th marriage. Their children despise them. They are alcoholics or recovering alcoholics, drug addicts or recovering drug addicts. Their wrinkled, grey, bald, furrowed and fallen faces look back every morning from the mirror, those folds of dying flesh bearing not a trace of the high, joyful and elastic smiles that once lit them. Their lives have been a ruin and a waste. All that bright promise never quite matured into anything that can be looked back on with pride or pleasure. They took that job in the city, that job with the merchant bank, stockbroker, law firm, accountancy firm, chemical company, drama company, publishing company, any company. The light and energy, the passion, fun and faith were soon snuffed out one by one. In the grind of the demanding world, their foolish, hopeful dreams evaporated like mist in the cruel glare of the morning sun. Sometimes the dreams return to them at night and they are so ashamed, angry and disappointed that they want to kill themselves. Once they laughed and seduced, or laughed and were seduced, on ancient lawns under ancient stones. And now they hate the young and their music. They snort with contempt at everything strange and new, and they have to catch their breath at the top of the stairs. Goodness, Stephen, who rattled your cage? Not everyone's life ends in misery, loneliness and failure. Of course, I know that. You're right. But many do. The entropy and decay of age is dreadfully apparent when set next to the lyrical dream of a Cambridge May Week, hackneyed, outdated, unjust and absurd as such an idyll may be. It is that scene that classical painters used to love, the golden lads and lasses sporting in Elysium, throwing garlands, drinking and embracing, all unaware of the tomb on which a skull rests, and never noticing its carved inscription, Et in Arcadia Ego. Why should they notice it? Its shadow will be on them soon enough, and they in turn will be wagging fingers at their children and saying, I too once lived in Arcadia, you know, and their children will not listen either. Many Canterbridgians might hear the foregoing and recognise not a word of it. Plenty of students eschewed with contempt anything close to a blazer or a glass of Pimm's. Most never lined the river on a May Bumps afternoon, never sipped planter's punch in the master's garden, never cunted up the Pam to Grantchester, nor once had to be helped to an ambulance and a stomach pump on Suicide Sunday. There were a lot of Cambridges. I'm just trying to remember mine, nauseating as it may be.
As well as all those parties, there were plays. Queen's College's drama club was called Bats, supposedly because of the flittermice that wheeled and squeaked in the sky above the Cloister Court during its end-of-term outdoor presentation, one of the most popular and distinctive regular features of May Week. This year's production was to be The Tempest, and the director, a Queen's second year called Ian Softley, cast me as Alonso, King of Naples. Being tall and boomy, I was nearly always given the role of a king or elderly authority figure. The young lovers, glamorous girls and handsome princes were played by students who looked their age. I never looked mine, but given that almost everyone was between 18 and 22, looking older was a distinct advantage as far as casting went. Ian Softley now directs motion pictures, The Wings of the Dove, Backbeat, Hackers, Inkheart and so on, but then he was a student with black curly hair and an appealing way of wearing white trousers. The cast included Rob Wyke, a graduate who was to become a close friend, and, playing Prospero, a most extraordinary actor and even more extraordinary man, Richard McKenney. In the middle of writing his PhD thesis, Trade Guilds and Devotional Confraternities in the State and Society of Venice to 1620, he could speak not only fluent Italian, but fluent Venetian, which is quite another thing. While waiting for the cast to turn up, he was always exactly punctual himself, as was I, he would pace up and down at high speed, humming every note of the overture to Mozart's Don Giovanni. If we were still not quorate, by the time that had been got through, he would move on to Leporello's opening aria and keep at it until everyone was present, singing all the parts perfectly from memory. On one occasion, Ariel was half an hour late owing to some confusion about time and venue. There was no way to text or call in those days. And when he at last arrived, red and gasping, Richard broke off from his singing and turned on him furiously. "What time do you call this, then? The Commendatore's dead and Ottavio is swearing on his blood to be revenged." Richard was a magnificent actor. His King Lear was astonishing in one so young. A receding brow and faux grumpy manner made him appear 50, although he can't have been much older than 23 or 24. But he hid his artistry under an obsession with pace and volume. "All you've got to do," he said, "is get down the front of the stage and have a good old shout." He once gave the entire cast a bollocking for adding 5 minutes to the running time. Un-for-fucking-givable. Every extra second is so much piss on Shakespeare's grave. I watched one afternoon as Ian Softley squatted in front of Barry Taylor, who was playing Caliban. "Do you know the work of the punk poet John Cooper Clarke?" he whispered, sorrowful brown eyes gazing deeply into Barry's.
Yes.
"I think, don't you, that we can afford something of that street anger in Caliban? Some of that rage?"
Forget about that," said Richard, who had been pacing up and down, hands clasped firmly behind his back. "Just get down the front of the stage and have a good old squeak and a gibber."
I don't suppose, with all due respect to Ian and John Cooper Clarke, there has ever been better advice given to any actor playing Caliban in the 400 years since The Tempest's creation. One morning I noticed a poster in the street for an exhibition at the Fitzwilliam Museum. They were going to bring out some of the Blake drawings, paintings, prints and letters that usually, due to their marked sensitivity to light, were kept hidden away in dark drawers. I mentioned this to Richard and asked if he was going. "William Blake," said Richard, "couldn't draw, couldn't colour in." McKenney is now a history professor at Edinburgh University. I hope they value him properly. Dave Huggins stopped me in Walnut Tree Court one afternoon. "My mum's coming to see your play tonight."
"Is she?"
I was surprised. Dave wasn't in the drama world, and it seemed odd for a parent to come to a production that her child...